From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today is the one-year anniversary of the emergency declaration because of poison water in Flint. What's ahead?
This is going to be a kind of a rough process as we sort of transition back, you know, from a public health emergency, really, to, okay, so at what point is the emergency over?
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that most so-called juvenile lifers should have a shot at a resentencing hearing. Should a judge or jury consider and impose that new sentence?
The conviction in these cases isn't at issue. All of these people stand duly convicted of homicide. The question is only what the sentence should be.
And what could business do in preserving sustainability efforts under President-elect Trump? Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we continue our week-long series, Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance? And we'll look at some of the victims in these cases, as well as the unanswered legal question that has halted the resentencing process for over 200 juvenile lifers. But first, today marks exactly a year since the mayor of Flint declared a state of emergency because of lead in that city's drinking water. Data show the water system as a whole is improving. Some good news for Flint families who've been relying on faucet filters and bottled water. But as Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith reports, filters and bottled water are likely to remain the way of life in Flint for the foreseeable future.
This didn't begin a year ago. For almost 2 years, officials told residents the water was fine when it wasn't. Later, they said, drink filtered water, unless you're a baby or pregnant. In that case, drink only bottled water. Then officials said tap water is safe for everybody, as long as you have a filter. But now, lots of people in Flint don't believe anything officials tell them.
Don't drink the city water. Don't drink Flint water, period.
Janice Badan ducks out into the snow outside the South End Market. It's on the end of a strip mall near downtown Flint. Officials may say Flint's water is safe if filtered, but Badan uses bottled water for nearly everything. There's only three things she uses tap water for: dishes, laundry, and to take a really, really quick shower.
You gotta be in there like maybe 5 minutes or something like that. If not, your body be all skelly and, you know, you be itching and scratching. And, you know, I'm going home and put a perm in my hair in a few minutes because it's looking rough, right? I gotta use bottled water.
In Flint, it's bottled water, even for the perm. That's how high the mistrust level is. At some point, Badan hopes to be able to use her tap water again. And that hope and question, when will the water be normal in Flint again, is one that researchers at Virginia Tech have been studying. Professor Mark Edwards has become a household name in Flint. He helped uncover the tainted drinking water, and he's continued to test water at hundreds of homes. And to be completely clear, no level of lead is considered safe. But the US EPA sets levels for water systems as a whole. Edwards says his data and a separate set from the state show that technically Flint's water may already be considered safe to drink by existing regulations. But
it's very likely in Flint, folks will never be told the water is safe as long as those lead pipes are there.
Those lead pipes are a big contributor to Flint's water crisis. They connect people's homes to the water main. And in Flint, there's an estimated 30,000 of them left underground. This year, Flint has replaced only 2% of those water service lines. 2%.
As long as those lead pipes are there, that's a hazard in front of your house that any time could cause lead poisoning of yourself and of your family.
Mark Edwards says data is starting to show that anyone with a lead service line, even people outside of Flint, are potentially at risk. Early next month, Edwards will join officials from all levels of government at an EPA summit in Chicago to make an official determination. If Flint's water is declared technically safe to drink, officials may still recommend using lead filters there, especially until the lead service lines are all replaced. That will take years. But any declaration of safety will face resistance from some Flint residents who doubt their water will ever be normal again. Resident-turned-activist Melissa Mays held a conference call this week to call into question the data showing the water is improving.
Everybody is upset. We just really need you to tell the truth and that we're not better. We're not safe. And I know we may sound crazy and we may sound emotional, but this is our lives.
Mays says testing a small percentage of high-risk homes, as outlined in the federal regulations, is just not going to make her feel okay about Flint's water. She won't rest until every single home in Flint is tested. All Flint residents can still get their water tested for free, but only a third of households have done so. For now, residents are supposed to rely on filters, though many are spending lots of time retrieving bottles of water for their everyday use.
And we've got Lindsay Smith here with us now. So, Lindsay, here we are on the one-year anniversary of this declaration of an emergency in Flint, and we have an all-out tug-of-war between the state of Michigan and federal Judge David Lawson. Twice now, Judge Lawson has ordered the state to deliver bottled water to certain Flint residents, not all, yet the state continues to fight that order. What's the latest argument the state put forth late yesterday?
Yeah, so this is kind of a different argument than has been presented in the past from the state. Really, this is the first time you're really seeing the state make the case that the water is technically safe to drink. This is like, according to existing federal regulations, it's not saying that, I mean, there are definitely areas of the city. You have tests that have come back even in the last month that you have lead levels that exceed the federal guidelines of 15 parts per billion. But as a whole, the system taken as a whole now appears to have numbers that show numbers that are similar to other water systems in Michigan that have lead service lines. I mean, you're going to have spikes here and there, but as taken as a whole, the water is definitely looking good. And so this is the state saying, you know, really for the first time, Judge, we think that come January, we will have some kind of announcement that will show everybody's on the same page, EPA, state, and city, to say that the water is technically safe to drink. So we shouldn't have to deliver bottled water to everybody.
Now, Lindsay, as the state has fought back against Judge Lawson's order, the state's position is, hey, we have set up centers around Flint. People can come and pick up free filters and cartridges and bottled water, and people can call 211 if they need something delivered. Is that not working?
I mean, there are plenty of people that are arguing that it's not working. When I was in Flint a couple of weeks ago, I asked people about this, and one lady was like, 211 is a joke. So it's tough to say, not being, you know, in Flint on the regular, but I will say that that is the crux of the argument here with the NRDC lawsuit, is that it's not working. And I think that for many people that are homebound, or, you know, you don't have a car, carrying water bottles on the bus, we see people like throwing bottles of water into their backpacks at the bus stop to take water home. I mean, if that's the case, it's not working. But that's the important part about what the state is arguing here with this latest filing. They're saying, I mean, the state right now is not saying bottled water is necessary. They outright say bottled water is not needed. You can use, everybody can drink filtered water. So you can sort of see how the state is gearing up to say, we shouldn't have to provide bottled water. We're providing filters. And because the water may technically be within existing federal guidelines, you know, do we even need filters? I mean, I think that they're going to try to continue to say that, so it looks like they're still, you know, they're still doing something. They still care. They still want people to have filters. But bottled water, I think, is, I would imagine, is going to be one of the first things that the state petitions to go.
And as we know, the state is supposed to file a compliance plan with Judge Lawson's order this week. And at the same time, let's talk about this, how the state has its eye cast on this meeting coming up next month in Chicago. What do we expect to happen there? Who will be there?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a big deal meeting in Chicago. This is going to be at the EPA's regional headquarters there. You're going to have EPA people. You're going to have people from the state, from the Department of Environmental Quality. You're definitely going to have the city of Flint officials, I would imagine, there as well. And you're also going to see some outside people, experts within the EPA, I imagine, will be there. And you're likely to see some people from Virginia Tech, Mark Edwards, and other scientists. I mean, they really want, you know, it's very obvious in Flint, nobody trusts government officials, period, right? Like, I don't think that's really an argument. So they want to make sure that they have a full spectrum of people that all agree on where Flint's water system is, on whether or not it's safe, and the recommendations that come in the future. Now, if I'm a guessing person, what I sort of see coming down in the tea leaves here is I think that you're going to get consensus that Flint's water is going to be technically in compliance with the federal existing regulations. But I also think that you're going to see the state say and the EPA say, please continue to use these lead filters, because we do still have areas where you'll get a spike of lead. And not only that, as we go into this summer and we really start ripping up these lead service lines out of the ground, that tends to stir things up and has a tendency to cause spikes in lead levels. So I imagine that even though you may see the state and the federal government say technically the water is safe to drink again, I imagine they're going to still say that you need to use certified filters for the time being.
It sounds, as you describe this, like they're trying to have it both ways.
This is going to be a kind of a rough process as we sort of transition back, you know, from a public health emergency, really, to, okay, so at what point is the emergency over and how do we know? I mean, and this is where a lot of this stuff is going to get spelled out. I mean, this meeting is sort of a first step. And then as we transition to the new pipeline, to another new water system, you're likely to see a lot of these questions come back into play. And I think the good thing is this time around, the EPA especially has come under such fire for their mishandling of this. I think that you're going to see, you know, there's so many eyes on this Flint water system that people are going to be really keeping an eye on things and looking for things to happen before, you know, they become a huge issue, as opposed to what the way things worked out the first time, which was like nobody did anything and ignored people and ignored a lot of the signs. And it was like they couldn't figure out who was the best person to act. So I think that, you know, this time around, we're going to see people be preventative. Regulators really try to stay on top of it. And the message is probably going to be confusing for a while. And honestly, even if they come out and say the water's safe to drink, and eventually I assume it will be safe to drink without a filter, who's going to trust it? I've talked to enough people in Flint to know not everybody's going to be on board with that just because they say it is.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith. As always, Lindsay, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still ahead, a new watch list reporting so-called liberal professors has academics across the country speaking out, including one from Calvin College, who's on that list. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Word came down recently that Shell, the second largest oil company in the world, has announced it's going to link top executive bonuses to progress they make on managing greenhouse gas emissions. In other words, if they don't hit targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, they will get hit in the wallet. It's yet another example of business, in this case a mammoth oil company, recognizing its long-term survival depends on its ability to reduce the environmental impact of what it's producing. And Joe Arvai believes that will help to offset President-elect Trump's pledge to kill off President Obama's sustainability efforts. Joe Arvai is director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Joe, it's always good to see you.
It's always good to see you. Thanks for having me back.
How would you describe your thoughts as you've heard the president-elect talk about climate change and environmental and sustainability challenges and who he's appointing as he's putting things together?
Well, I would be lying if I wasn't a little bit alarmed at what I'm seeing. I think the appointment that gives me the most concern is of Myronie Bell as the person to lead the transition of the Environmental Protection Agency. This is a person who has come out as a skeptic of climate change, basically as a denier of the scientific consensus behind climate change. So that alarms me. But that said, I'm taking a glasses half full view here. I think that there are some firewalls out there, as you pointed out in your opening. I think big business and even small business is one of them. So I think that a lot of things have to happen to get out in front of this, but I think that we can work with this at least in the short term.
And that's your piece in theconversation.com, why Trump's vow to kill Obama's sustainability agenda will lead business to step in and save it. So let's talk about what you see happening in business, big ones like we said in Shell, but small ones as well. Why are you seeing this trend of money flowing where sustainability grows?
There's a couple of things that are happening, in my opinion. One is that companies don't like to work in fits and starts. They like to have clear agendas in front of them. They put plans in place. They set them in motion, and they evaluate them over time. What we see when we see President-elect Trump coming in and talking about rolling back regulations, making it a little bit easier for business to maybe act in a manner that isn't 100% sustainable, businesses have been working for the last 8 years under President Obama, setting in motion an agenda that's responsive to things like the Clean Power Plan, that's responsive to changes in terms of our cultural values around sustainability, which began to emerge even before Obama took office. So to think that now business will sort of put on the brakes, put on the shelf all of the investments they've made, get into their time machine and go back to 2008, I think that's unrealistic. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think that's good for the environment. There are other factors as well. I mean, I think consumers are coming around to really demanding sustainability in terms of the products they consume, in terms of the foods they eat, in terms of the companies they support. Companies are in business to make profits, and when they see their consumers asking for something, I think that they also have to be cognizant of the fact that they have to respond in the future.
Is it just consumer-facing companies, the ones dealing directly with people that are committing to sustainable practices, or are suppliers on board as well?
Suppliers are absolutely on board, and I think this is where the real untapped source of progress is. If you look, for example, at consumer-facing companies like General Motors, there's a demand there for sustainably made products and also products that are going to be sustainable over their lifespan. So what does GM do? They introduce the Chevy Bolt. They commit to radically increasing the portfolio of renewable energy that they're going to use to manufacture their products going forward. On that latter front, and actually on the former front too, when it comes to the Bolt, what goes into that car is going to have to come from suppliers of raw materials. The energy that goes into those plants to produce those vehicles is going to have to come from companies that are producing that energy in a sustainable way. So if we look right here in Michigan at a company like Consumers Energy, they're responding to expectations from companies like GM to produce more of their energy in a sustainable manner. We look at what's happening in Grand Rapids. The large data center Switch has agreed to move to Michigan, but the condition was that they wanted 100% of their energy to come from renewables. Someone in Michigan has to provide that. So once again, we see these behind the curtain suppliers responding to the needs of consumer-facing companies that are really moving sustainability forward.
What about labor? What kind of role might labor have?
You know, this is an interesting one. I think when we look at our typical blue-collar workforce, the people that really make the economic engine run, the demographic is very similar to what we see in the vote demographic. Mm-hmm. So in that area, I think that there are some people who really have strong sustainability passions and others who don't. So there I don't see a lot of movement on the labor front. Where I do see it is in people coming into management positions, people coming out of business schools like the Ross School of Business here at the University of Michigan. Increasingly, students who've got their undergraduates in a BBA-type program or their MBAs, they're also becoming much more interested in sustainability and kind of overall well-being as part and parcel of kind of that portfolio of goods you get from your employer. So I see them increasingly voting with their feet and also in some respects with their wallets. There was a study out of Yale saying that people coming out of business schools are willing to accept lower salaries from companies that they perceive as being more sustainable to the point that they're actually willing to turn down some of those positions. So if the most talented, brightest minds coming out of programs like ours are going to begin to behave that way, I think it behooves companies that still have some progress to make on the sustainability front to really put in motion plans that make sure that they remain competitive with labor.
But can business with the support of chunk of the consumers and can it do it all? I mean, doesn't government play an outsized role in all this?
Yes, you're absolutely right. This is a fantastic point. And this is the one that I think we have to be very careful of. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the piece in The Conversation and when I've been talking about this with students and other people in the community, I talk about business as a bit of a firewall. But like any firewall, if the flame is sustained, if it gets really hot, sooner or later, that firewall is going to erode. Historically, what we see is the best progress on the sustainability front. And I'm not just talking here about things like the environment. I really do mean broad sustainability, the sort of three pillars of economic security, social security, and also environmental well-being. There, the best progress has been made when government, when regulation and business works hand in hand. And what concerns me here is the leadership shown by the Obama administration over the past 8 years might not be there with the Trump administration. And listen, this isn't a political point. This is really a fact. The President-elect Trump was elected on a platform where concerns of a broad swath of the population were geared towards the economy, were geared towards security, were geared towards borders. So I would be shocked to see a big pivot towards the environment. So there, if that leadership is missing, I begin to worry. I think CEOs begin to worry as well. I was in a meeting where I had a chance to speak with the CEOs of companies like Total Energy out of France, Renault, the car maker. And what they're telling me is that in order for them to go into their shareholder meetings and talk about the things they want to do on sustainability, it's suddenly a whole lot harder without leadership from government, because their bottom line in a lot of those meetings is to increase profits as best they can. So the trade-offs balance maybe more in the direction of profits over sustainability. When government can step in and can provide some additional incentives, whether it's a regulation or something in terms of a tax break, for example, it becomes an easier case for business to make. So I think in a perfect world, we'd be seeing some leadership from the government here. But as I wrote, time will tell. I don't know if that's going to happen. I sure hope it will, but I'm not terribly optimistic on the government leadership front at the moment.
Joe Arvai, Max McGraw, Professor of Sustainable Enterprise and Director of the Erb Institute for Global Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us, Joe.
Oh, I'm always happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
To some, the idea of a watch list raises uncomfortable thoughts and worries about infringement on people's constitutional rights. And there is basis in our history for that worry. The Red Scare from Senator Joe McCarthy in the 1950s. The post-9/11 terrorist watch list with its various secondary lists, such as the no-fly list. As lawsuits challenge the constitutionality of these watch lists, courts are ruling they are treading on due process rights spelled out in our Constitution. Now there is a new website called Professor Watch List. Its self-described mission, and I'm quoting here, is to expose and document college professors who discriminate against conservative students and advance leftist propaganda in the classroom. Professor Watchlist is a project of Turning Point USA. It's a conservative group founded by Charlie Kirk in 2012. Here with me is a Calvin College professor who teaches social work. Joseph Kylema's name was put on this watch list just a few weeks ago. Joseph, welcome to Stateside.
It's great to be here.
Tell us a little first about your work and your time at Calvin College.
I've been at Calvin for about 8 years now, and I teach primarily social work. So I teach communities and organizations classes. I teach a capstone course on the integration of faith and social work. And I've been pretty involved with some partnerships that we have in West Africa. So I was pretty surprised to be put on the list. Calvin College is not known to be a radical institution by most folks. Many folks would hear Calvin College, think West Michigan, and think of a more conservative institution. And in many ways, that's probably the case.
Well, certainly Betsy DeVos is an alumna. She, of course, is Donald Trump's choice for education secretary. And if I'm remembering correctly, George W. Bush, when he was president, gave the commencement speech there in 2005. So Calvin doesn't quite fit the profile of a place that is advancing leftist propaganda.
It does not. And so I was initially surprised, but on sort of further reflection, I think it makes quite a bit of sense. Both of the aspects of my identity that I would sort of put forefront, social work and Christianity, have both been labeled as dangerous ideas throughout history. So for social work, I would look back to Jane Addams, the founder of Hull House, one of the matriarchs of our profession. She was put onto a watch list in the 1920s for her work on pacifism, work against First World War I and then World War II. And J. Edgar Hoover, the longtime head of the FBI, once labeled her the most dangerous woman in America. Both for pacifism, for her work with immigrants, for her work with the poor, for her advocacy for social justice. So I think on a little further reflection, I think that makes a lot of sense for a social worker to be on the list like this.
Joe, what is your understanding as to why you landed on the Professor Watch List?
So my understanding is that this list is primarily culled from alt-right and far-right media sources. I don't think this list is in any way an objective assessment. I think there are many of my colleagues who would say, look, what Professor Kalama teaches is what we believe as well. I think you saw this out of Notre Dame. Notre Dame had a couple professors, Gary Gooding and one other professor, put on the list. And dozens of Notre Dame professors said, hey, we would like to be on the list. We teach the same things. What I think happened here was certain of us have written pieces that have gone around the alt-right web, and those of us who rose to that level of attention or had something go viral have been singled out and sort of put on this list to make examples out of us.
This stemmed from an incident, and correct me if I'm wrong here, on November 22nd, where a couple of students reportedly drew swastikas and wrote the words white power in the snow on several cars at Calvin. Is that what kind of prompted this?
Yeah, so this happened a little over a year ago. Our campus is still sort of working through this. A couple of students, as you said, drew a swastika and wrote white power in sort of the fresh snow on the back of a car. What their intentions were, I think, are sort of irrelevant. It caused a lot of fear for our students of color. Intentions aside, whether it was intentioned as a hate crime or a joke, doesn't matter. The impacts were real. And as we struggled to wrestle with how to respond to this as a campus, I wrote a piece saying, hey, I think we at Calvin are good at condemning sort of overtly white supremacist language and symbols, but we sometimes struggle to condemn the idea of white privilege or the idea of institutional racism. And I made the argument that if you reject that notion, if there is no such thing as institutional racism or privilege, then I think you are assuming a degree of white supremacy. So I wanted to say, hey, look, it's easy to condemn the swastika, but we've got a lot of work to do as a community to say, to acknowledge the legacy of institutional racism, even within our own denomination, within our own church, within our own college.
And we should note, you were saying this is November 22nd, 2015. So this is not something that happened like we've seen quite a burst of similar incidents since Election Day.
Right. So this was pre-election. We've certainly had some incidents on our campus since the election. I think many campuses have, whether those are microaggressions or more macroaggressions. But this was prior to the election, and that piece got picked up by Tucker Carlson's website, The Daily Caller. And from there, it sort of ricocheted around the list of usual suspects. So it was picked up by InfoWars, who is now in the news for propagating the Pizzagate myth.
Yes.
A bunch of Tea Party and Patriot News organizations, all the way over to neo-Nazi groups like Stormfront.
What is your take, Joe, on the purpose of watchlists like Professor Watchlist? What does advancing leftist propaganda even mean in the context of exchanging and exploring ideas on a college campus?
Yeah, I don't pretend to know what Charlie Kirk exactly means by that. I'd be very interested in hearing him, because if you ask any of my students, what I actually teach is critical thinking. You know, Calvin's mission as an institution is to equip students to think deeply, to act justly, and to live wholeheartedly as Christ's agents of renewal in the world. I would say that's what I do. In fact, I would say that as a social worker and as a Christian, I am actually very interested in dialogue across groups on trying to understand the other. None of my students would have ever said that they felt like my classroom was an unsafe space. That's what makes it so ironic that I'm on the list, because my inclusion on the list is strictly on the basis of this viral article and not any sort of substantive evaluation of my teaching. I don't think these are radical ideas to act justly, to think deeply, to think critically. In fact, in a post-truth moment, I think that's what we need more of.
So the watch list really does seem to, as was pointed out in an opinion piece by George Yancey in the New York Times, the watch list is consistent with this nostalgic desire, quote, to make America great again, which in turn can certainly be seen as especially threatening for people of color.
I think George is right about it, that I think the idea of making America great again is predicated on a notion that America was universally great for everyone at some point in the past, and the truth is that it was not. America is a great nation. I'm happy to be American. I'm proud to be an American. I would consider myself a patriot, but we have to wrestle with the legacy of genocide of the Native Americans, of chattel slavery, where we literally owned other people. America has never been sort of universally great for everyone who wanted it to be great for them. As Langston Hughes, I believe, has said, America was never America to me. I think we need to wrestle with that. And so I get concerned about the pairing of a nostalgia for a previous time and the rhetoric of an anti-political correctness. It's really the pairing of those that concerns me. Because we have people saying this whole notion of social justice, this whole notion of being careful about how we talk about other people, we need to get rid of that, and we need to go back to a time when we could say whatever we wanted about people. And I just find that abhorrent.
What do you think, Joe, this type of watch list, this professor watch list and this mindset, what does this mean for what could happen in the course of teaching, of academia, of exploring ideas?
Well, I would be very concerned if this sort of silenced folks. Now, I don't think that will be the case. It certainly hasn't silenced me, and I don't think it will. But I would be very concerned if institutions then felt pressured, pressured from donors, pressured from parents to go after these professors, to monitor them more closely. I think that's a dangerous road to go down. I think academia needs to be a place where we can engage issues from multiple perspectives, but do so critically. And if we can't do that, especially, again, in a post-truth moment when it is opinion and feelings that seem to matter, I think any attempt to sort of silence truth-speaking is extremely dangerous.
Joseph Kilema, professor at Calvin College, whose name was put on the professor watch list a few weeks ago. Joe, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
It was my pleasure, Cindy. Thank you.
Coming up, Michigan's juvenile lifers. Who gets a second chance? Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our series, Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance? Michigan prosecutors have a pretty big job in front of them, sifting through hundreds of cases, some of them decades old, to try and figure out which of the 363 people sentenced to life without parole should get a chance at freedom. That task was handed to them by the U.S. Supreme Court, which said automatic life without parole is unconstitutional for anyone younger than 18. Michigan Public Radio Network's Shana Roth reports prosecutors are trying to balance the rights of so-called juvenile lifers against the promises made to the victims of their crimes.
In his office in downtown Grand Rapids, Kent County Prosecutor Bill Forsyth has stacks of boxes up against a long wall. They're labeled and stuffed with transcripts, police reports, autopsy reports.
That's about half of what I had when we started.
About a year ago, the U.S. Supreme Court said states had to review the cases of juvenile lifers who were sentenced before automatic life was declared unconstitutional. The court said automatically sentencing juveniles to life without parole was cruel and unusual punishment. That brings us to Forsyth's stack of boxes. He and other prosecutors across Michigan have to decide which of the lifers from their counties should get a shot at parole. Inside those boxes are the stories of those inmates, but those boxes also hold the stories of victims and their family members who now have to revisit painful events they thought were behind them.
So there's a lot of anger, a lot of mistrust in the system. They just don't understand, and I don't blame them.
That shock of having a case opened up again is the reality of hundreds of people. People like Jody Robinson.
That is my dear brother. Way back when, because it's been so long.
I met Jody Robinson at a diner. She's showing me old, faded pictures that she copied onto her phone. Her older brother was killed in 1991. He was stabbed to death on Mother's Day on his way to deliver his mom a card. The defendants were then 16-year-old Barbara Hernandez and her older boyfriend. Hernandez's sentence is among the many cases in Michigan up for reconsideration.
What people don't understand if they have never been through it is you truly do go back to that day.
This kind of pain is not lost on prosecutors, whose job, in part, is to seek justice for victims and their families. Jessica Cooper is the prosecutor in Oakland County. The Oakland County Prosecutor's Office handled the Hernandez case back in 1991, before Cooper took office. Cooper is asking the courts to uphold the life sentences for 44 juvenile lifers, including Barbara Hernandez. But she still had to tell the victims that their cases would be back in court.
While they may have moved on or at least have had some type of closure, that I was there to rip off that scab one more time. And that was impossibly awful.
I met Maura McCallman at a two-story house in Port Huron, in a neighborhood that overlooks the bridge to Canada. McCallman's small, blind pug curled up in her lap, and a German Shepherd the size of a small pony laid nearby. In 2010, McCallman and her husband were attacked in their home. Her husband was killed. The attack was orchestrated by their adopted daughter, Tia, who was a month shy of her 18th birthday.
You know, after you go through a trial and you go through a sentencing, that's just supposed to be it. And that has not been the case for us.
The St. Clair County case has been appealed numerous times. It's currently waiting on whether the Michigan Supreme Court will hear arguments on whether judges or juries should decide resentencing for juvenile lifers. McCallman says it feels like victims and their families have been disregarded in the debate over juvenile lifers.
In some respect, it feels like when a horrible crime has been committed and years or time has passed, that we start, people, not we, because I don't, but people start turning defendants into victims, and that's really not easy to see or read or hear about.
For victims like Maura McCallman and Jody Robinson, that is the real cruel and unusual punishment.
That was Michigan Public Radio Network's Shana Roth reporting. There is one correction to note. Jody Robinson's brother Jim was killed in 1990, not 1991. We turn now to the unanswered legal question mentioned in the story you just heard, which has halted the resentencing process for a majority of Michigan's so-called juvenile lifers. Here's the question. It's whether judges or juries should be the ones to determine whether life without parole is a suitable sentence under the Supreme Court's standards. Now, the court has said life without parole for juveniles should be rare. But in Michigan, according to the State Appellate Defender Office, which is handling a large number of these cases, prosecutors are seeking life without parole again for over 60%. That's more than 200 juvenile offenders. And not much is happening with these cases until this question is resolved. Yesterday, we asked Genesee County Prosecutor David Layton about the judge versus jury question, and here's what he said.
I think you have to retry the case if you're going to get a jury of lay people to understand why it is we're here today asking for juvenile life without parole. You can't do it just based upon new evidence. You have to be able to show everything that transpired, and it would require a retrial of that case.
Here with us now is Kimberly Thomas. She's a clinical professor of law at the University of Michigan and the co-founder of the school's Juvenile Justice Clinic, which is representing Tia Skinner, one of the people convicted in the case you just heard about in Shana Roth's story. Thomas argues it should be a jury to decide whether a juvenile should receive life without parole. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You argued before the Michigan Court of Appeals that a jury should decide that life without parole punishment for a juvenile offender, and the appeals panel agreed. What did you argue? Why should a jury decide?
Well, a jury should decide because the Sixth Amendment says if there are facts that increase someone's punishment from what just the verdict in their case, that those facts should be found by a jury. And the comparison that I think is really helpful for us to think about here is the death penalty context. And so the U.S. Supreme Court has said over and over again that those facts that are being found that subject someone to the death penalty have to be found by a jury, and that the Constitution requires that.
So you argued this, and the appeals court panel agreed with you, but then something happened. Some other judges on the appeals court disagreed with their colleagues' ruling. So they convened something called a conflict panel. Tell us what happened and what a conflict panel is.
The conflict panel is when there is a decision of the Court of Appeals that goes one way and another panel that says, well, if we weren't bound by that prior decision, we would go another way. And they ask the court to resolve that conflict between the groups of individual Court of Appeals judges.
And how rare is a conflict panel in your experience? Have you seen one before?
I don't see them that often in criminal cases, which is my area. No, I don't.
And as we heard the Genesee County prosecutor in this earlier clip, he argues that you'd have to retry the whole case if you want a jury to consider the sentence. And I'm assuming that you disagree. Why doesn't the case have to be completely retried, in your view, for a jury to be able to decide the sentence?
So the as I said, that the death penalty can give us some guidance on this. So even if a case comes just for a sentencing hearing, and the case has already been tried years and years ago, and sometimes that happens, those facts that are going to be found to make someone eligible for the death penalty in other states still have to be found by a jury unless the person waives their right to a jury. And so those same kinds of procedures could be implemented in these cases.
Is it basically doing a whole retrial, as he argued?
No. I mean, each party could decide to agree to what information could be heard. The conviction in these cases isn't at issue. All of these people stand duly convicted of homicide. The question is only what the sentence should be.
So you again, back to he feels you'd be pulling out the records and digging up things from maybe decades ago, but you're saying that that's not necessarily the case.
So what the court has told us in Miller and Montgomery is that the question for sentencing focuses on the individual, not on the crime. The crime has occurred. The crime.
Everybody agrees on the crime.
Everyone agrees the crime happened and the person is guilty of that crime. The question is what that shows about this offender. Does the crime show that this person is irreparably corrupt? Has this person shown that they've made efforts to rehabilitate themselves? What does that look like?
So in Michigan, it has always been the judges who determine sentences like this. Let's listen now from Kalamazoo prosecutor Jeffrey Getting.
Normally, when we think about the criminal justice system and the person who has the authority to make that decision regarding the consequence to be imposed, we're talking about the court. And we're talking about making a decision after being provided with all of the information from both sides, advocating, as I do, for the people of the state of Michigan and for the victims of the crime, and on the other side, advocating for the defendant, the person who was convicted of murder.
So he's saying there that both sides, the prosecution and the defense, should present their arguments before a judge as to whether a life without parole sentence is warranted. How does this rise to a finding of fact and therefore should be considered by a jury and not a judge?
So what really I believe the Sixth Amendment requires is that initial finding of fact that would subject someone to a life without parole sentence. And the court has said, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that we need can only give a life without parole sentence to someone who's only eligible for life without parole if they've been shown to be irreparably corrupt. And so once a jury determines someone is irreparably corrupt, I don't disagree with Mr. Getting that a judge could make a determination of the appropriate sentence within that range. It's just that the jury has to find that fact that allows the sentence of life without parole.
That term, irreparably corrupt, is there a hard and fast guideline that lets you know when you've crossed that boundary, or is it something that's rather fluid?
There's no hard and fast guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court at this point what that means. The court has told us that that's the line, that we need to focus on, and I'm sure that there'll be a lot of discussion in the years to come about what that means, how you determine the rare case that should be eligible for or could be eligible for life without parole from the common case that should not be.
That's going to be batted around a lot, I can tell. Is that something ultimately that you could see the court deciding?
Yes, and our Court of Appeals began to address that question. In the conflict panel case in Hyatt, the court said that on appellate review, the court should look as inherently suspect a sentence of life without parole, trying to implement what the Montgomery court held in terms of, you know, really it being the rare case.
And I wondered how much of a challenge do you think that these prosecutors in Michigan are going to be faced in changing the way they're used to doing things? It seems like almost a change in culture and the way they view their role in the criminal justice system.
I think that Montgomery and Miller will force that change and have required that change.
What change? Just how do you see this change?
How I see the change is we've gone from what used to be the status quo in Michigan where life without parole for a young person was not considered to be unusual, was not considered to be something that we would have to think carefully about or examine the details of that person's life. In fact, it wasn't even permitted by statute, to a situation where the U.S. Supreme Court has told us that as a matter of constitutional law, we have to do that and we have to only impose life without parole in the rare circumstances. And so that is a change.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Kimberly Thomas, who's a clinical professor of law at the University of Michigan, and she's the co-founder of the school's Juvenile Justice Clinic. The prosecutors with whom we've spoken, to a T, all say their priority lies with the victims and their families. And yes, they have discretion to decide the charges, but if the families want to reimpose a life without parole sentence, most said they would go with what the family wants. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that there are a few things. The prosecutor has an independent duty as a matter of their position to represent the people. And so I think, you know, that obviously they're going to listen to the victims' families, and that's an important part of their role. It's also important for them to have a system-wide or county-wide view of the situation. And so in a lot of studies, for example, the death penalty, there's been some disparity by victim and victim's family in terms of who received the death penalty. And so you wouldn't want, I think we would all disagree with just having a victim who's particularly vehement or particularly articulate, and that person getting life without parole, and it not being based upon also the offense of conviction, the circumstances of the offense, the offender, and whether he or she has shown rehabilitation. So it's really much more than just, and that's an important factor, but there's more that needs to be considered too.
Why do we leave it to prosecutors in Michigan to make these decisions? Could we be taking other approaches?
So the U.S. Supreme Court had said that in Montgomery that certainly a constitutional approach would be to translate all of the sentences to parolable life sentence and shift that authority for release to the Michigan Parole Board. The Parole Board would then, under that kind of system, have the ability to release or not release based on whether they believe that the person has shown to be rehabilitated would be safe to be released to the community.
But we're not doing that now.
No, that's not the system that our legislature set up. But the Supreme Court has said that would be an alternative for states to adopt.
And have other states adopted that?
Some states have gone that way. States have really done a variety of different things. A number of states have just chosen to eliminate life without parole entirely because they think that that's a way to solve the constitutional problem, to save the state the money of redoing all of these cases over again. And, you know, so that's obviously another approach that's been taken.
What do you see next in terms of when the Michigan Supreme Court will take up this judge or jury question? When are you expecting a ruling?
I don't know. I can't read those tea leaves. But, you know, the question is presented to them if they want to hear it. They might decide to see what happens with other cases before they hear it. That's really in their prerogative.
Well, in the meantime, what's happening with all the people who were sentenced to life without parole and have not been considered for a new sentence? Where are they?
For cases where prosecutors are seeking life without parole, those cases are largely on hold right now, to see whether or not the Michigan Supreme Court is interested in deciding the question of judge versus jury.
And if they're not, then what?
Then I think that prosecutors will have to make decisions about whether to go forward. Obviously, no one wants to do these hearings more than once. You want to do them in a way that is final and will, you know, resolve it for once and for all.
Michigan has gotten national attention as an outlier in this. What are your thoughts on where Michigan stands compared to other states?
So Michigan had a very large number of juveniles serving life without parole at the time of the Miller verdict. And so I think just the sheer numbers has drawn attention to Michigan to wonder why Michigan is different in that way. And then I think some of the other states with a large population of juvenile life without parole have taken a slightly different approach. For example, Pennsylvania had even more, but about 300 of those are out of Philadelphia County, where the city of Philadelphia is. And the prosecutor there has indicated that he's going to not seek life without parole on almost all of those cases. And so there's a different approach that's been taken there.
And why? Why? I guess I'm wondering why so different in so many Michigan counties than what you just described in Philadelphia?
I'm not sure, really. As I mentioned, there's that history of prosecutors having choice on this. I think it'll take a while for Miller-Montgomery to sink in. But beyond that, I'm not really sure.
Kim Thomas, University of Michigan law professor, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And you heard Kimberly Thomas mention Philadelphia and the approach they're taking with juvenile lifers. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody went to Philadelphia to learn more, and we'll have his story on Friday. Meanwhile, our series tomorrow will continue, Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance, with an exclusive interview. Out of Michigan's 363 juvenile lifers, only one so far has been released from prison and given a second chance.
until I walked through the door, and when I peeked around the corner, I see my mom's peeking at the same time, so we peeking at the same time. It was believable. It was real, you know, so.
That is tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Rusty Brack, and our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.